Welcome to Critical Friends, the Strange Horizons SFF criticism podcast. I'm Aisha Subramanian.
And I'm Dan Hartland. In every episode of Critical Friends, we'll be discussing SFF reviewing, what it is, why we do it, how it's going.
In this episode, we're sitting down with veteran critic Paul Kincaid to talk about his own history of reviewing, the process of anthologizing and collecting criticism, and why you should read Maureen Kincaid Speller's forthcoming collection.
We began by trying to establish whether we even like books. Okay, so we are here with the esteemed Paul Kincaid. After what I have to admit was a little bit of a summer vacation last month, which was mostly my fault, because my idea of a summer vacation is to move house.
You're weird.
It has been said. The moment as well, like I'm sure many people listening to this are the same. There's that moment when you're moving house when you realise, oh, I really did buy a lot of books.
There's also quite a prolonged moment, possibly weeks and months, of really, really hating books.
Yeah, I haven't got through that yet. I'm still there.
I mean, all they do apparently is take up space and collect dust.
The last time we moved house was 1990. Because the experience was so horrendous that we decided not to move again.
I don't think you should ever move again after...
what I remember from that is the number of occasions you pick up thinking, why do we have multiple copies of this book? And equally, the number of times you're looking, I'm sure we had that book. Where is it?
And there are these moments of clarity, aren't there, where you're moving house and you realise these things. But then, I don't know, what is it, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 3 months into the new house, you're like, no, no, definitely need to buy those duplicate copies again. Like, and all the habits. But great. I'm in the moment of transition.
Can I give you a promise, a look to the future? When you get as old as me, I'm now in the process of downsizing the number of books. I have to get rid of some books. Doing some building work on the house, there's less space. So I have to get rid of a fair number of books to allow for everything else.
Is that as painful as it sounds?
It's worse.
Well, thank you for that vision of my future.
It comes to us all.
Well, one of the things that would be really useful to talk about is... related to your self-confessed, these are not my words, great age, which is, Aisha and I recently were looking through the Strange Horizons archive of reviews. Names come and go often. So there are people that produce a lot of reviews for a short period of time, and then they go away. Some people come back. And there's this undulating coming and going of names. That's not the case with your name, Paul. You're just always there. And I just wonder, what is the source, if you even know, of this persistence that you keep reviewing, you keep doing criticism?
I think part of it is very simply, that's what I do, and it just never occurred to me to not do it. I've been writing criticism in one form or another since the late 70s, and it's sort of ingrained. I don't think about it now. It's just a natural way of doing it. And when I'm reading for pleasure, I end up thinking in my head how I would review this book, what I would do, what I need to say about it, what it opens up for me. So it's an ingrained habit of mind.
Is that an unalloyed good thing? So you mentioned, so even when you're reading a book, quote unquote, for pleasure, not for review, you're kind of reviewing it. I mean, is that something that gets in the way? Is it something that you're grateful for?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes it's a right pain. There are times when you just want to shut off. I'll give you an example. A few months ago, I read Daisy Jones and the Six. Because there is nothing like anything I have ever reviewed, ever would review. It is as far away from what might be seen as my province as possible. And I was reading away quite happily, and I suddenly found myself constantly thinking about the technique, about the structure of the book, and about not what I was reading. I was reading, but the shape of what I was reading. Even something like that, I just can't get away from it. It's a pain sometimes, but it's also interesting.
And is that something that happens to you with things other than books as well? So is it a specifically literary thing that you do, or does it kind of affect texts of all time?
Kind of, but not to the same extent. Mm. Films and television, I tend to regard them that way when I have an idea that I might want to review it.
That's really interesting. To link it back to the original question about persistence, the persistence is linked to some extent. There's a weak link, but it's a link with books specifically. I mean, is there ever, it sounds like there is, that there are moments when you wish, oh gosh, I wish I didn't have to be this way.
Yeah, obviously. And there are times, I mean, quite frankly, there are times when you're reviewing a book and you know you're reviewing the book and you think, God, I wish I didn't have to do this. It's, I'm reading a book at the moment, the big book of cyberpunk.
Is that the Jared Shuren?
Yes, yeah. Yes. 1,150 pages and I'm about 800 pages into it. Part of me is going to really enjoy writing the review. I've got a lot of it planned out in my mind already, and I've got far more notes than I've got space for in my review. But at the same time, I'm thinking, oh God, really? Can I just put it? You know, it's, I've been doing this for days and days and days and days and days. Can I just go away from it, leave it? It's just so big. I don't think anybody who isn't reviewing the book will ever read it beginning to end. It's not that sort of book. And quite frankly, if they do read it beginning to end, I pity them. But when you do read it beginning to end, you see connections, repetitions, links, and you can't stop yourself. I can't stop myself.
That's so interesting, because you have just answered the first question, which is you just can't stop yourself. So there's no noble answer to this persistence, you know, to your contribution to the field over decades. It's just because it's what you do and you can't stop it.
The simple response to that is I never thought about it as a contribution to the field. This is just what I did. Other people interpret it as a contribution to the field, but I actually think if I started thinking those terms, I'd freeze up.
From what you just said, that idea that you do this work and you put it into the world or into a particular publication, and presumably the hope is that someone somewhere is going to read it and enjoy it. Is there a point when you start thinking of yourself as someone who is being read?
I've got to see it in my terms, not in some sort of noble endeavour on the sake of the whole of science fiction. Because that would be soul destroying.
One thing that strikes me about contributions to the field is absolutely they're in the eye of the beholder. It's interesting that you bring up the Shuren book. Any anthology is also itself a form of criticism, right? So you're reviewing it, doing criticism. Mm. But in collecting those stories and in writing the introduction, Jared is also doing criticism.
Oh, yes, very much.
It begins to get a bit recursive, does it? How do you avoid that when you've been especially doing it for such a period of time that you've been through several of these critical moments?
I've been putting together a third collection of reviews and essays and things that I'm hoping will be coming out sometime in the next couple of years.
Is this an exclusive for Critical Friends?
Probably, yes. Ooh. But I'm not going to say who's potentially publishing it or anything like that. The draft I originally did included all my reviews of collections of reviews, because I've done a lot of them. And I read through the whole thing at the end, and I've decided to take all of those out because it's too recursive. I'm going in a circle that you can't get off of. So I'm leaving. I'm taking out the reviews of reviews. I have this vision of writing a book that's made up of reviews of reviews, but the reviews themselves were also of reviews. And there's no end to that. And I just it's crazy. It was doing my head in, so I'm going to take them out.
One of the consequences, you know, of the perseverance is that you keep you wind up with this kind of back catalogue that you anthologize in one way or another.
Yes.
How did you begin building up that back catalogue? Like, this is the obvious question to ask, but it's such I do find it interesting because almost every reviewer has a slightly different story. Like, you say that it's that you do it because you do it, but there was a point where you didn't do it. So how did it begin?
Okay. This is going back to the early 70s. I was at university in Northern Ireland, and at University of Ulster. And where I was living at the time, there was only, other than the university bookshop, there was only one little newsagent that had books in it, and most of these tucked away in a rather difficult to reach corner of the shop were those old digests of sized compact booked editions of, you know, New Worlds, science fantasy, things like that. So I amassed quite a few of those and was reading them, and actually that is where I really got thoroughly into science fiction. So when I moved on to do a postgrad at Warwick, I discovered purely by chance that there was a science fiction convention in Coventry that Easter, the year I was at Warwick. So I thought, God knows, I'll go along and see what it's like. And I did, and rather enjoyed it, started getting involved in fandom. And of course, when you're in fandom, there's all these things called fanzines. And I thought, you know, everybody was doing them. So I thought I should at least contribute to them. But I didn't feel comfortable writing the sort of jokey self-revelation type pieces that made up most of British fan writing at the time. So I thought, I'll write about a book. You know, we're all science fiction fans. We obviously like books. And I just read Chip Delaney's Triton, as it was then called. And having studied philosophy at university, the thing that struck me was the philosophical bit at the end of the book, the afterword. So I wrote about that. And it was, I was rejected by a fanzine, but there was a comment in the we also heard from bit in the next issue of that fanzine saying somebody even wrote to me to tell me that Delaney's Triton was all about philosophy. That was it. That was the sum total of my impact on science fiction fandom at the time. But I'd started doing it. I'd started doing it because I couldn't think of anything else to write. I did write a few stories, but they were mostly crap. The one thing I seemed to be able to do was write book reviews. So I got into writing reviews for Vector. That time, the late 70s, there was a big, basically a revolution in the BSFA. A new breed of fans, the younger fans, were sort of taking over from those who'd been running the organisation for years. And I found myself part of that new company, and therefore I was, you know, one of the writers that they kept turning to for reviews. And that was it. I just started. So at that stage, you had 400 words for a review in Vector. And I was doing at least one review per issue for a lot of the time. practice, you just start finding yourself doing it more and more and more, and it becomes, it just become just what you do, the way you are, the way you perceive books. It's like I started there rather than getting to that place.
The question I asked was, there was a point where this wasn't what you do, but your answer is no, it was always what I did as soon as I started doing it. It was just how I did it.
Yeah.
Was that how everyone else was doing it? Because I'm conscious you're talking late 70s, so this is after Mike Harrison at New World. So was how you do things being done elsewhere? Did you feel different?
I didn't feel different. I was reading book reviews. I mean, I'd read a lot of Mike's reviews and John Clute's reviews for New Worlds, and picking up what reviews I could. I always read reviews in the newspapers. There used to be reviews in newspapers in those days. And I suppose you just absorb it. It by osmosis, you just absorb that sort of critical angle.
So you were conscious of being part of a critical community, might be too strong a word, but
far
a
too
tradition,
strong a word.
Tradition?
I'm not even sure I'd grace it with that strong a word. It was more like that was just where I positioned my own writing. I wrote reviews and all these other people wrote reviews, so I was presumably part of it, but I didn't see it as a unity. I didn't see myself as part of something that was going on.
Earlier, when Dan was asking about how much you felt that you were part of a kind of critical community or tradition. I suppose the difference between those two things is with a tradition, you're aware that other people have done work and you're responding to it, whereas with a community, there's a sense that you are one of the people being responded to.
Ooh, I like that. I occasionally, very occasionally, get emails from people I've never heard of saying how much they enjoyed something I wrote or something like that. That's always, yeah, gratifying. Must have been my second collection, Call and Response, was published or had a launch party, as it were, to coincide with the London Worldcon in 2014.
It was 14.
The memory is going, you know. But the launch party, so it was me and John Clute and Gary Wolfe. And I felt simultaneously the junior in that company, but also in that company, because they're both writers I respect as writers as well as critics, even though I couldn't write like John to save my life.
In anyone.
I presume there's a pasticheur somewhere who might be able to do it, but yeah, I couldn't. John was always scary. When I first got into fandom, John was the scary one, because people knew he was erudite, but they didn't know how to take him. So you'd always get warnings about John and how fearsome he was. And I worked out pretty quickly that the reason everybody else found he was fearsome was because nobody dared to challenge him. He knew more than anybody, so you didn't argue with him, and therefore he became this object more than a person. But I challenged him. I argued with him. I always have done, ever since I first met him. And I got the distinct impression that John enjoyed that. So that's how I feel I got into that group without actually ever feeling I was a member of the group. I was still part of it.
One thing that strikes me is that I think what you were just talking about, Clute, could go for critics more broadly as well, because the sort of trick of criticism, I don't know whether you agree, is that you have to write this thing that is robust and holds up to scrutiny, so seems complete. But actually, one of the reasons that we do criticism is because we like to have these kind of conversations. A critic produces something that seems quite final, and a good critic produces something that seems very final. But like Clute, kind of want to argue about it anyway. And I just wonder whether, to return to Aisha's question about being read involves having an audience, but also does it involve engaging with that audience too? Or do you just write the things and let them go?
Oh, God, do I? There are, given the number of reviews I've written over the years, bloody hell, awful lot of them. There are certainly reviews I've just written and let them go. Contractual obligation reviews, if you get the meaning. I didn't really want to write it, or I didn't really have anything to say, but I produced something and sent it out there. But most of the time, I write to express my view, but not to overwhelm everybody else's view. I like arguing. I like to win in arguments. I like to be the one who comes out ahead. But at the same time, I do like to argue. I like to challenge people to change their mind and to have myself challenged to change my mind. And it does happen. I think if all you're doing is the passive job of putting words down that just go out there and that's it. You know, they're out there. They're no longer part of you. You never hear from them again. You know, they've left home and never write. That feels sort of redundant. It feels like a wasted opportunity. And I don't like wasting opportunities.
So I was listening to, are we allowed to talk about other podcasts?
Of course we are.
It depends. Not too much praise, though.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this other terrible podcast that no one should listen to called Decoding TV. It's presented by Dave Chan. They did a recent special episode on, I don't know whether you saw the New York Times piece about movie criticism on TikTok, which caused a bit of a stir in certain circles. There was lots of sort of discussion about studios get involved in funding various movie critics on TikTok and YouTube. Is that good? Is TikTok as a format even able to do criticism? All those sorts of things. But the podcast was so good because it held a lot of space for the idea that, hey, TikTok is the platform that the next generation have. We can't necessarily change that so much. Dave and Patrick Klepek, who were having the conversation, came up in blogs, which I suppose you and I did, Aisha. And then, Paul, you came up in paper fanzines.
Because I'm ancient.
Yeah. I didn't say Gutenberg. You know, you weren't hand-pressing the... Well, actually, maybe. Anyway, the...
I have done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So each generation has a slightly different story of how they come up, which affects the format or expectation of not just what they produce, but also that dialogue, that engagement that feels like an important part of the process, but is different for each generation. And I don't know where I'm going to land on this myself, which is why I'm going to turn this into a question, which is, do you notice those changes as you move through them, Paul? Because I mentioned, you know, the Strange Horizons archive that you appear in very early on. But Strange Horizons, you know, if we go, Mike Ashley, Rise of the Cyber Scenes, it was leading edge when you first landed on that. So do you consciously move through the platform? So do they just kind of find you? Do they change how you write? Do they change how you don't let the reviews go? Like, what impact does that change have?
Let's go back to the idea of moving through platforms. When I started writing, I was writing on paper. I was using a typewriter as well, you know, really ancient stuff. And, you know, you'd send it off and it would, with luck, appear some weeks or months later. I got into the habit, I always read my reviews when they finally appear, partly because in those early reviews, they appeared so long after I'd written them that I'd forgotten what the hell I said. And it's a way of reminding myself. So you start doing that. The types of magazines you write for start to change, you know, as you become competent or develop interests that lead you into new areas. So you start writing for different magazines, you start writing for different journals. You know, I moved from things like Vector and fanzines into things like Foundation and more academic journals, things like that. I got into the TLS a few times as well, which is rather pleasing. So you're changing you're changing your approach slightly with each one, but not as much as you'd think. You know, you're writing 400 words for Vector and writing 1,200 words, 1,500 words for Foundation. Obviously, there's a difference because of the length, which is a difference in how much you can say, and therefore a difference in the way you can structure an argument. But the argument itself is not necessarily that different. And then online magazines like Strange Horizons came along, and in a sense that was, you know, I moved naturally into those. I still write for print. I still write online. I have a blog, which I write occasionally. So you use different media, and it allows you sometimes different modes of expression. But it's not that different in the substance of what it is you're saying. That's my experience. It's not always what I pick up. I mean, let's say when the book blogging phenomenon really got going, I got really, really irritated with the people for whom the most important thing was cover reveals or unboxing or things like that, because it's that turns the book into an object, not into what a book really is, which is a mode of expression, a part of your interior cinema, if you like. And there is always that carry through in what I write, whatever the media. That what I'm writing about is the substance of the book, the substance of what is going on within that book. I've never been remotely interested in the book as object. When Maureen and I got married, there were people down, we have the party here at our house, there were people going along the shelves and taking books off and just checking whether they were first editions or not. And I think they were disappointed that many of them weren't first editions, because I'm not that sort of book collector. I like my books for the content, not for whether it's a first edition or anything as special or anything like that, because the book as object really, really doesn't interest me. So that approach to books, which I don't think I can justify by the name criticism, is one of the things that irritated me. But as long as there are people about writing about what's inside a book or talking about it, as we're talking here, that's okay. That I like, that I can go with. And the actual medium isn't going to bother me too much, so long as what I do with that medium is on the same spectrum as what I do whenever I'm talking about a book.
And I'm also sort of slightly thinking about now how much I care about books as object, and to what extent I do or don't.
I mean, we began this conversation talking about my experience with having an awful lot of objects that are books.
Yes.
Like Paul, I don't collect the first editions. I don't even check, really. But nevertheless, I also still prefer to read the book in its paper form. So if I'm reviewing a book or just reading for pleasure, I still kind of enjoy most of all holding the paper book, rather than I read on Kindle, I review on Kindle. Other e-readers are available. I prefer the experience. So there must be some element of me liking the book as an object. But I would agree, Paul, that it's not the thing itself. It's not the primary purpose of the reading, which I think for some people, yeah, just having them is the thing. Which I get. They are lovely things to have, but yeah.
I suppose the one exception would be illustrated books or graphic novels or anything that involves something other than just words on a page. There you need to talk about such things as reproduction, how they come across on the page, how they fit within the text and things like that. So you're talking about something slightly extra literary in that. But in the main, no, it's just the words.
Yeah, and it feels like the discussion that we started off with was essentially the disconnect between wanting to have the content of the books available to you and the massive inconvenience of their physical forms just taking up space in your house.
And yet, like Dan, I'm not a great fan of ebooks. I read them, but I don't think I've ever read an ebook purely for the pleasure of reading a book. The only times I read ebooks are when it's a book for research or it's a book for review.
I think I'm the opposite in some ways. I will read an ebook for pleasure, but if anything that for pleasure, but also for quite a casual kind of reading experience. But for anything where I feel like I want to pay attention and where attention is going to be a big part of my thinking about the book or my enjoyment of the book, that's when I want the physical copy. So yeah. I read a lot of sort of trashy historical romance in ebook form because I can just read that and I don't have to really. It is one of the times where I can turn off being a critic, to go back to something else that we talked about.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think I can do good critical work with an ebook. I've had to sometimes, but it's not as much fun.
Whenever I'm offered a book for review and it, you know, they say, you know, you can have it as an ebook or you know, I'll see if I can get a finished copy. I always ask for the finished copy if at all possible, because there's something about the way the words are arranged on a printed page compared to how they're arranged on a screen that makes a big difference in appreciation of the text, I think. And I really don't understand that. It's some sort of animal instinct in my mind, I suppose, but it's the case.
I'm interested that this exchange began, Paul, with you saying that you weren't interested in books as objects, but in fact we've realized that something about, if not this sort of objectiness of them, but something about the physicality of a text does influence the reading. And I completely agree, me too. For me, it's actually about part of my technique of doing criticism. So I'm an awful person that writes on pages and sticks notes in things and, you know, finds parts of a text by physically applying myself to the pages. And that is so much less effective an approach with a digital file.
I've been sorting through some of Maureen's books. I've a lot of her books on Native American literature and politics. I've donated to her PhD supervisor because he and his students will get more use out of them than I ever would. But some of them, you don't actually have a book. You have this rainbow of little post-it notes sticking out around the side, and actually working your way through it is almost impossible. I honestly don't know how she did that.
Well, since you mentioned Maureen, I wonder whether we could talk briefly about her collection, which is coming out later this year. And I know you've been super involved with the editor of that book, Nina Allen, in kind of producing it and so on.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know where to start with this, because but we've spoken about your volumes of reviews, which of course were produced, if you like, in harness. So you're creating, you yourself are overseeing the kind of the canon, if you like, the Kincaid canon.
God, yeah, it is, but it's a horrible thought,
isn't it?
Yes.
And that's not the situation here, right? So other people are doing that for Maureen.
Yeah, she wouldn't have done it. Honestly, she wouldn't have done it. We lived together for 30 odd years, and I spent most of that time trying to persuade her to produce books. And she would nod and say yes, and then not do it. And there'd be an excuse, there'd be a reason. She never got around to producing anything like that. And it would have happened with this. If she had been doing this book, putting this book together, it would never have appeared. There would have been some reason not to go ahead with it. Probably right at the last minute, but it would not have happened. It wouldn't have appeared. The only way that a collection of Maureen's writing could come out is if somebody else took on the task of compiling it. And Nina did a brilliant job. Heartily grateful that she actually, after she started that, Paul March Russell suggested doing the same. So something would have appeared of Maureen's writing anyway. But this collection is excellent. And it's the only way it would have appeared.
Do you know why? Do you know? Because it's so interesting, isn't it? We've spent the last sort of minutes or so talking about reviewers and why we review and, you know, how we do it and where we do it. The process of then sort of winnowing that product down into a canon. Why did Maureen do most of those things? Do you know? And then just was not interested or just didn't feel at the last moment, as you say, that the book was a thing that she could or wanted to do?
Very practically the first thing I ever talked to her about was to persuade her to review for Vector. I was reviews editor at the time when we got together, and she kept putting me off for quite a long time, saying, I've not read enough. I don't know enough. I can't trust myself on this. And eventually, you know, obviously she did start writing, and she wrote very good reviews right from the start. But I think that sense of herself as not being quite good enough, not being quite knowledgeable enough, not having read quite enough, was a persistent part. It stayed with her throughout her life, and she couldn't shake it.
So I agree that the volume is great. Aisha and I have seen the text of it. And in her introduction, Nina does talk about Maureen as a woman in criticism. And that must have been part of that feeling that she had, right? Because I'm conscious, you know, we've spoken about when you were coming up, Paul, and we're talking about, you know, Mike Harrison and John Clute and Gary Wolfe, and this surely that's part of the picture here.
I'm sure it is. Fandom, which Maureen and I both came through fandom, though we came at it slightly different ways, but fandom was always incredibly sexist. Throughout the time I knew it, there were more and more women getting involved, but they were never, I think, central. Right into the 90s, I suppose, which is pretty much the time we started being somewhat less engaged with fandom, but right into the 90s, conventions would have women in X panels, and they were often the only panel at that convention with any women on the panel. It wasn't conscious, but it was something that was just done. Everybody did it. Nobody thought about it. And therefore, any woman trying to establish herself, trying to have opinions, was going to have a hard time of it. I get it in the neck sometimes on, you know, for some particular views or something like that. But basically, I don't get it in the neck for being a critic. Maureen would have done. And I wouldn't have seen most of it.
So I think that's one reason why the collection is so important, actually, because here is work, as you say, which hasn't yet been collected, despite the fact that it clearly is worthy of the volume.
Mm.
And does demonstrate from its breadth and depth and the publication dates, that even though perhaps the visibility still isn't there, women critics are writing if we provide the platforms. And we're back to that word platforms again.
Yes. There are, thankfully, many more women writing criticism now, and it's often some of the best criticism out there. I don't want to say that there's a difference in tone, a difference in quality in the writing because she was a woman. There is a difference in tone, there is a difference in quality because she was Maureen, and because she had that very distinctive outlook on what she was doing. But I suspect at some points it would have been easy for other people to dismiss it because, not because it was Maureen, but because it was a woman.
And the volume is a Traveller in Time, which is out with Lunar Press. I think it's September, isn't it, Paul?
Well, I think the official launch date is that launch at FantasyCon in... So that is that the 16th?
It is, yes.
Official launch date, but it's available to pre-order all over the place now. It's available. It should be bought. It is worth reading. Partly because her voice, her voice comes through on every single page, and it's very distinctive, very sharp, very funny. I remember many, many times reading her stuff and thinking, I wish I could write like that.
When we published the tribute issue to Maureen, one of the things that came through in an awful lot of the things that people wrote about Maureen was that voice. Yeah, it's distinctiveness, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought she was a better writer than me. And don't argue with it. That's just the way I feel.
So A Traveller in Time obviously is a collection of writings. And so to go back to something that we were talking about earlier, where we were talking about your collections, Paul, and deciding ultimately to leave out certain things because you didn't see them as being necessarily that valuable or as being too recursive. Yeah. And obviously with something like this volume, there's a much stronger need to not leave things out. But on the other hand, a very limited space to do it.
I haven't counted. There's an awful lot of pieces in here, but it's nowhere near comprehensive. Whether all the pieces left out would be worth collecting is another matter. But there were a lot of things that she wrote that aren't in there as well. It was probably another collection's worth, at least. Choosing what goes in. I mean, I'm glad Nina took this on, because I hate doing it when I'm putting my own collections of reviews together, because you're trying to second guess yourself all the time. You know, you're thinking, oh, does that review really work the way you think it does? Or, you know, is that saying anything worthwhile, or is it just repetitious? You know, are those two pieces just doing the same thing? Should you just drop one of them? You always get it wrong. That's just the way these things work. But it's a nightmare job. As I was saying, you know, I put together material for another collection a few months ago, building on something I'd been sort of noodling with for a long time before then. I sent it off as a draft, as it were. And the moment I sent it off, I was thinking, no, yeah, those pieces, take them out. You know, they don't work. Or maybe I should add that piece in. Or you're always arguing with yourself. Editing like that is a nightmare job. I don't know how editors per se do it. Like you, I suppose.
I'm not sure how editors do it either. So
the thing about putting a collection together is not amassing the material. The material's all there. You just jam it together and then you cut it out. Putting a collection together is about removing things, not putting them in. This collection had two pieces from the 1990s. Everything else was from this century. Hmm. You know, they were pieces I had a lot of time for when I wrote them, so I automatically included them and put them in. Then I read the whole thing no, they're not too old now. They're not relevant take them out.
Because there's an element there, isn't there, of it feels like a volume of that sort is a retrospective, but currency is still important to you by the sounds of it. So, you know, the older pieces felt old. So even in a retrospective, they don't go in.
I think it's a matter of noticing your own style. And style changes. The way I write now is nowhere near the way I wrote 20, 30, 40 years ago. And you look at pieces like that and you think, does it actually look like it's the same author? To somebody else, it may do, but I'm too close, too intimately connected to it to not feel that what I'm doing there doesn't quite work. Not in the way that I would if I was doing it now. It's not thought through, not carefully planned, but more a matter of instinct as you're going through it. Mm-hmm. That sense, I don't know what's wrong, but it's wrong.
That's my approach to criticism, full stop.
The thing about writing criticism is that you really have to understand what it is you're reading. And if you don't understand it, you can't see what's right about it or what's wrong about it. But if you write a piece of criticism that doesn't say what's right or what's wrong about the piece, you're not doing criticism. You know, it's essential to approach each new book or collection or whatever with essentially a blank mind, a blank canvas, and then see what fills it up, what things stand out that you want to make a note of, what things stand out that you think, oh God, that's horrible, that really shouldn't have been done, or that's a wonderful piece, that needs to be emphasized. Yeah, you've got to be aware of not necessarily how the thing works, but how it works for you. Because criticism is always intensely personal. You're writing for a public sphere, but you're writing personally about it. It is your own mindset that is engaged with the work, and it can't be anything other than personal. I am no judge of what I've said. I can't even remember what I've said, mostly.
And you're producing a collection of your own work, are you, Paul?
Well, I've... yeah. Yeah.
Unrelatedly.
Unrelatedly, and...
Thanks for listening to Critical Friends, the Strange Horizons SFF Criticism Podcast. Our music is Dial Up by Lost Cosmonauts. You can hear more of their music at grandvalise.bandcamp.com. See you next time.